critical dialogue, shared values, shared responsibilities, and informed judgments, while promoting authoritarian narratives that disdain historical consciousness, critical thinking, and the idea, if not principles, of participatory democracy. Hard boundaries, precarity, a culture of fear, untrampled individualism, an all-encompassing ethos of self-help, and a profound unease constitute the currency of Trumpism. In this instance, economic justice, meaningful solidarities, and the common good are removed from the discourse of politics and citizenship. Pilgrimage again.
The years of war in Syria were difficult years, a time when Syria was the source of bad news. Before the war, Syria was so peaceful that it seemed it was solely created for pilgrims to visit it and seek tranquility, a place of pilgrimage for Muslims and Christians alike. But war killed and destroyed so much of Syria that perhaps it has killed the memories of the past too, the memories held in the minds of those who had seen Syria before the war. War has ended in many Syrian cities, and this means that pilgrims can once more travel to Syria for pilgrimage. With this hope that pilgrims will once again set foot in this land, we will visit the different pilgrimage sites in Syria and see how they have survived the war. Aleppo is Syria's largest and most populated city. It is also among the oldest cities in the world that has linked the East to the West for many centuries. Aleppo is not only a city for Muslims, many Christians also live in this city. In fact, one of Aleppo's tourist attractions is the many beautiful churches in the city. Historically, Aleppo has been famous for its bustling bazaars, its textile industry, its seminaries and universities, and the Aleppo Citadel. These are all what makes Aleppo important and special. And perhaps due to its importance, terrorists tried relentlessly to fully occupy the city during the war, but they were never successful. This enduring war has left Aleppo with scars. In the city, one can find prosperous and bustling neighborhoods next to neighborhoods that have been fully destroyed. For Muslims, especially Shia Muslims, Aleppo is home to two important sites, and it was always visited whenever Muslims travel to the city, Mashhad al-Hussein and Mashhad al-Muhsin. It is said that when the Karbala caravan enters Syria from Iraq, it stayed near a church for one night. A holy father from the church noticed that there is a light shining up to the sky from Imam Hussein's decapitated head. That is why, by paying a hefty sum of money to the soldiers, he managed to borrow the Imam's head for a night. The Holy Father baptizes it and places it on an altar. This altar is now a pilgrimage site. The current building was built around Mashhad al-Hussein. Its architecture resembles that of old churches in the area. Mashhad al-Muhsin is also related to the events of Ashura. It is said that Imam Hussein's wife was pregnant, but the baby was lost after the incident of Ashura. The baby was named Muhsin and was buried in the place that later became known as Mashhad al-Muhsin. These two pilgrimage sites only stand 300 meters apart, but during the war in Aleppo, it was the border between the terrorists and the resistance. The terrorists managed to invade and occupy Mashhad al-Muhsin, but they were never able to set foot in Mashhad al-Hussein, despite all their efforts. Yet this pilgrimage site was severely destroyed by the war. After the war, Shia Muslims reconstructed the site, and now both pilgrimage sites are ready for pilgrims to arrive. In Aleppo, there is a tomb that is said to belong to Zechariah, which is located in the Great Mosque of Aleppo. This mosque was originally constructed in the first century of the Islamic calendar. During the war, the Great Mosque of Aleppo was occupied by terrorist forces, and that is how this historic monument was transformed into this ruin. With the liberation of Aleppo, the restoration of the Great Mosque of Aleppo started. This is why all the original pieces of stone were carefully recovered and meticulously recorded so that they can be put in place during the restoration project. Currently, this mosque is not open to visitors or pilgrims. But after its restoration, this mosque and the tomb will certainly be a destination for pilgrims visiting Aleppo. Thank you. To see the rest of Syria's pilgrimage sites, one must travel from Aleppo towards Damascus. The first place you will come across is Adra. The tomb of Hujr ibn Adi is located in Adra. Hujr was a close companion of Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali. He never agreed to swear allegiance to Muawiyah and continuously disclosed his corruption. And that is why Muawiyah ordered him to be killed. When Hujr was apprehended, he was given the chance to use profanity against Imam Ali in order to live. But he did not agree. Hujr, along with his son and a number of his companions, were martyred in the 51st year of the Islamic calendar. In August 2013, terrorists occupied the region and entered the mosque where the tomb of Hujr was located. They destroyed the building and desecrated the grave and claimed to have removed the corpse from its original resting place. But after the liberation of Adra, it became evident that the terrorists had only dug less than a meter deep, and since the body was buried much deeper, the terrorists never actually managed to reach it. This site was later restored by Iraqi defenders of the shrine and other Shia Muslims. This site is ready for pilgrims to visit it. On the outskirts of Damascus lies the Mosque of the Prophet Abel. It is located 45 kilometers from the capital city of Syria. This site has always attracted pilgrims to Syria. After visiting Adra and the tomb of Hujr, the caravans of pilgrims reached Damascus. Historians claim that the city of Damascus dates back to 3000 BC. It is the oldest city in the world that still stands, and people are still living in it. Damascus is just as sacred to Christians and Jews as it is to Muslims. But for Shia Muslims, Damascus is home to a few sacred sites, and one of them is the Bab el-Saghir Cemetery. It is a large cemetery in the center of Damascus that is the burial site for a number of the Prophet's companions and children of the 12 Imams. The most important of which is the tomb of Kulsum, the daughter of Imam Ali and Hazrat Zahra. Close by is the tomb of Sakina, the daughter of Imam Hussein. These two tombs are located in one chamber, and pilgrims can easily visit both. It is believed that Bab el-Saghir Cemetery is also the burial grounds of Abdullah, the son of Imam Sadiq Fatima Sughra, one of Imam Hussein's daughters, and Abdullah, the son of Imam Sajjad. The graves of nine of the Prophet's companions are also located in this cemetery, the most notable of which is Bilal, the first muazzin of Islam. Another companion of the Prophet is Abdullah Ja'far Tayyar, the husband of Lady Zainab, His tomb is adjacent to that of Balogh's. According to some historical documents, three of the Prophet's wives, Salame, Habibe, and Hafsa, are also buried in this cemetery. Faize and Asma, Hazrat Zainab's maids, are also buried here too. Next to Bab el-Saghir Cemetery is a holy place which is believed to be the burial site for the heads of 16 martyrs of Karbala. They belong to Hazrat Abbas and his brothers, Ali Akbar, Imam Hussein's son, Abdullah and Qasim, the sons of Imam Hassan, Habib ibn Mazahir and Hur are among the 16 heads that have been buried here. This area is separated from the cemetery, and inside the shrine there are 16 turbans that signify the 16 heads. There are other historical narratives that say that there are only three heads belonging to Hazrat Abbas, Ali Akbar and Habib ibn Mazahir buried here. Bab el-Saghir Cemetery was threatened many times by the terrorists, but with the resistance of the people and the army, it was never occupied. This cemetery remains as one of the major pilgrimage sites of Damascus. The Umayyad Mosque, also known as the Great Mosque of Damascus, is one of the main tourist attractions of Damascus. Parts of this mosque date back 1,400 years. The mosque was built on the site of a Christian basilica, which was the burial ground of John the Baptist. With the construction of the mosque, the burial site of John the Baptist was included inside the building, and Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, and Christian pilgrims visited. In the Umayyad Mosque, there are four rectangular halls. One of them is dedicated to Imam Ali, but among Shias, it is known as Ra's al-Hussein. When the Karbala caravan reached Damascus with all of the decapitated heads of the martyrs and the family of the martyrs as captives, they entered the Umayyad Mosque where Yazid was. It is said that the holy head of Imam Hussein was placed where the shrine stands today, known as Ra's al-Hussein. Next to it is a prayer rug and mihrab encased in a glass cubicle, which marks the place where Ali ibn Hussein Zain al-Abidin used to pray while imprisoned in the castle after the Battle of Karbala. The Sayyida Ruqayya Mosque. This mosque is found a short distance from the Umayyad Mosque and contains the grave of Ruqayya, the young daughter of Imam Hussein. After enduring the Battle of Karbala and the torturous journey to Damascus that followed it, Ruqayya reached the Umayyad Mosque. As she could not bear any longer, one night the orphaned three-year-old dreamed of her father and woke up and cried relentlessly. She cried so hard that the soldiers informed Yazid. He ordered the guards to show her the decapitated head of her father Imam to make her quiet. And Yazid was right. The three-year-old Ruqayya was silenced forever. This tragic and moving incident has captivated the hearts of not just Shia pilgrims, but Sunnis and Christians alike. From the very first days of war on Syria, the occupation of Damascus was the terrorists' main agenda. That is why many of the suburbs on the outskirts of the city were occupied or were ceaselessly targeted by the terrorist rockets. One of these suburbs was Daraya, which the terrorists managed to occupy. This suburb was considered as a very strategic base for them as it was located only 5 kilometers from Damascus. It took 5 years of war to liberate Daraya. It is not too hard to guess what the terrorists did to Hazrat Sakina's shrine while they occupied the area. The shrine of Sakina, the daughter of Imam Ali, was completely destroyed when Daraya was occupied by the terrorists. The occupation has razed Daraya to the ground. The town is in ruins, and the Syrian army has not yet allowed it to be open to the public to enter. And devoted Shias are awaiting the time when the Syrian government reopens the gates of Daraya and they can rebuild the shrine. For sure, the main reason pilgrims travel to Syria is to visit the shrine of Hazrat Zainab. The terrorists almost reached it. They only had 100 meters to go, but they never managed to occupy it because of the resistance forces blocked them. The resistance forces included Syrian Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims from Syria, Lebanon, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. The Iraqi resistance forces could not bear to see the shrine empty of pilgrims, so they brought in their family members from Iraq for pilgrimage during those difficult days. And thus, the shrine of Hazrat Zainab became the central hub for the resistance forces. And the valor of the resistance in defending the shrine inspired resistance forces across Syria. Now pilgrims can visit the shrine of Hazrat Zainab in absolute safety and security.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, a Republican who has been out of office for 2 years, was in his post when state-appointed managers in Black City of Flint switched the city's water to the Flint River in 2014 as a cost-saving step while a pipeline was being built to Lake Huron. However, the water was not treated to reduce corrosion, a disastrous decision affirmed by state regulators that caused lead to leach from old pipes and spoil the distribution system used by nearly 100,000 residents. The disaster made Flint a nationwide symbol of governmental mismanagement with residents lining up for bottled water and parents fearing that their children had suffered permanent harm. In this regard, we have prepared for you a news report written jointly by Ed White and David Egger, titled "Michigan Plans to Charge Ex-Governor Snyder in Flint Water Probe." This article has appeared on the front page of the Associated Press News Agency's website. Here's the detail. Former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, his health director, and other ex-officials have been told they are being charged after a new investigation of the Flint water scandal, which devastated the majority black city with lead-contaminated water and was blamed for a deadly outbreak of Legionnaire disease. Two people with knowledge of the planned prosecution told the AP recently that the Attorney General's office has informed defense lawyers about indictments in Flint and told them to expect initial court appearances soon. They spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. The AP could not determine the nature of the charges against Snyder. Former Health Department Director Nick Lyon and others who were in his administration, including Rich Bird, a friend who was the governor's key troubleshooter while in office. Courtney Covington Watkins, a spokeswoman for the Attorney General's office, said only that investigators were working diligently and will share more as soon as we are in the position to do so. Snyder, a Republican who has been out of office for 2 years, was governor when state-appointed managers in Flint switched the city's water to the Flint River in 2014 as a cost-saving step while a pipeline was being built to Lake Huron. However, the water was not treated to reduce corrosion, a disastrous decision affirmed by state regulators that caused lead to leach from old pipelines and spoiled the distribution system used by nearly 100,000 residents. Snyder's attorney, Brian Lennon, released a blistering statement recently saying a criminal prosecution would be outrageous. He said the state prosecutors have refused to share information about these charges with us. Lennon claimed rather than following the evidence to find the truth, the Office of a Special Counsel appears to be targeting former Governor Snyder in a political escapade. Snyder apologized for the catastrophe during his 2016 State of the Speech and said government at all levels had failed Flint. Lee Ann Walters, a mother of four who is credited with exposing the lead contamination, said she wants details about the charges. Walters said the very fact that people are being held accountable is an amazing feat, adding, "But when people's lives have been lost and children have been severely hurt, it doesn't seem like enough." The disaster made Flint a nationwide symbol of governmental mismanagement, with residents lining up for bottled water and parents fearing that their children had suffered permanent harm. Lead can damage the brain and nervous system and cause learning and behavior problems. The crisis was highlighted as an example of environmental injustice and racism. At the same time, bacteria in the water was blamed for an outbreak of Legionnaire. Legionella bacteria can emerge through misting and cooling systems, triggering a severe form of pneumonia, especially in people with weakened immune systems. Authorities counted at least 90 cases in Janice County, including 12 deaths. The outbreak was announced by Snyder and Leon in January 2016, although Leon considered that he knew that cases were being reported many months earlier. In 2018, Leon was ordered to stand trial on involuntary manslaughter charges after a special prosecutor accused him of failing to timely inform the public about the outbreak. His attorneys argued there wasn't enough solid information to share earlier. By June 2019, the entire Flint water investigation was turned upside down after more than 3 years and millions of dollars. Prosecutors working under a new attorney general, Dana Nessel, dismissed the case against Leon as well as charges against seven more people and said the probe would start anew. The decision didn't affect seven people who had already pleaded no contest to misdemeanors. They cooperated with the investigators and their records were eventually scrubbed clean. Leon's attorney said he was turned down when he asked prosecutors for a copy of new charges. Chief Chamberlain claimed the new case would be a travesty of justice. Testimony at court hearings had raised questions about when Snyder knew about the Legionnaire outbreak. His urban affairs advisor, Harvey Collins, told a judge that the governor was informed on Christmas Eve 2015, but Snyder had told reporters 3 weeks later, in January 2016, that he had just learned about it. Defense attorney Randy Levine said he was informed recently that Bird, a Flint native, would face charges. Another lawyer, Jamie White, said former Flint Public Works Chief Howard Croft is being charged. Levine said of Bird, when the Flint water crisis hit, he wasn't assigned by Governor Snyder to go to Flint, but rather he raised his hand and volunteered. A resident, Edna Sabuco, 61, said she still uses water filters, although the lead service line at her home of 40-plus years has been replaced, along with more than 9,700 others in Flint. Sabuco said of Snyder, he swept things under the rug, in my opinion, and to me that makes him just as guilty as everybody else, because he should have some outshining like a canary. Separately, the state, Flint, a hospital and an engineering firm have agreed to a $641 million settlement with residents over the water crisis, with $600 million coming from Michigan. A judge is considering whether to grant preliminary approval.
Ministry.
There's no doubt that the military aggression against Lebanon became inaccessible to the pattern adopted by the Israeli enemy since 1978, which acquired another form of aggression that targeted the supporters of the resistance in the only country that has so far defeated Israel. All plans failed, so Washington decided to suffocate the allies and supporters of the resistance by implementing economic sanctions and by designating Hezbollah an international criminal terrorist organization, all while supporting the largest terrorist entity on the planet, Israel. This new plan required making judicial arguments, assembling files, and falsely linking them together to establish the party's involvement in terrorism and drug crimes on the one hand, and assigning Israel's proxies in the U.S. administration to oversee the implementation of penalties and prosecute people alleged to be affiliated with the party. Their last attempt at sabotaging any entity related to or affiliated with Hezbollah was hacking the party's Al-Qard al-Hassan financial institution. Qard al-Hassan is a 36-year-old association that grants small loans with zero interest to help borrowers manage their life hardships, like rebuilding houses, opening small businesses, and covering marriage hardships, regardless of their religious affiliations. Despite the institution's assurance that hackers had no access to any of the internal data or account numbers of depositors, the hackers, till this day, keep posting Excel sheets that anyone can fill or scanned files of depositors' IDs or procuration papers. All the leaked documents were scanned photos, obviously taken from a certain folder of the internal administrative communication database between the different departments of each branch and between branches. It was not that of the actual database of the depositors' account details. Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah clarified last week that Al-Qard al-Hassan Association gives loans on the basis of mortgaged gold or a mutual guarantor between the borrower and the association, and in no way or form does it fund Hezbollah. Another plan to twist the arm of the resistance falters. Actually, it gave a great marketing push for the association, which saw a considerable turnout of new depositors to open accounts after the speech of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Hezbollah, which has been suffering from 4 years of Trump's maximum pressure campaign against its resistance forces, is hesitant to show optimism following Joe Biden's presidential election victory. Washington's approach resulted in multiple sanctions on Hezbollah members and companies linked to the political bloc. Add to that, high probability of hostilities continue to materialize on the border with occupied Palestine, making the chances of a sudden escalation increase steadily. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, Lebanon's economy is highly dollarized, Dr. Saleh, which gives Washington a tremendous leverage to use economic sanctions to deter the Lebanese public from supporting their own resistance back home, the liberation movement in Lebanon. The U.S. has managed to target several political allies of the resistance in Lebanon as well. Now, do you think that they might move forward towards targeting civilians now, or rather just back off after maybe Trump just leaves office?
Well, hi. I guess the United States has used all what it has in order to put down the ambience of Hezbollah, the popularity of Hezbollah. Fortunately, they did not succeed, especially the people, the environment, are embracing this resistance, highly embracing this resistance, and the speeches of Sayyid Nasrallah last one and before the last show this confidence of the people in the region towards the resistance. So I guess the Americans, whatever they use of their instruments or sanctions, the resistance was and still able to overcome all these silly decisions from the American administration, especially
one of the major targeted associations that were linked to Hezbollah and lately targeted, maybe late 2020, was the Qard al-Hassan Association, which is a financial institute that gives out interest-free loans and allows for commission-free deposits. This association was hacked, and I actually spoke with the directors of Qard al-Hassan, who are not doing any media interviews so far up until now, but they told me that the hacked server was that which was used for internal administrative communication between the branches and between departments of one branch in particular. So it was not that of the actual database of the depositors' accounts information, rather just Excel sheets that anyone could actually put out there and maybe a couple of scanned files, which include maybe IDs and procuration papers. Do you think that this is enough damage to affect the reputation of such an institution and at least maybe shake its reputation in front of the depositors?
Well, I believe the statements was made by Al Qard Al Hassan, managerial committee, and that would not influence the clients of Al Qard Al Hassan, and the people, they have a sufficient confidence of this institution, which helps poor, helps students and doctors and people who want to have a loan in order to buy a car. This is very small thing, I guess, in terms of the people, especially in this crisis. You mentioned the economic crisis in Lebanon. However, I would say Al Qard Al Hassan accelerated its activity. The people now, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, the people would go to Al Qard Al Hassan and put deposit in this bank, their only bank without interest, and they have full confidence of their money that it's in a safe place. That's why I guess all the these hackers could not influence the trust or even influence the Al Qard Al Hassan institution and the programs, the computer programs. They issued this statement. People were relieved, and they are having this good relationship between the clients and the managerial committee.
Mind you, we should also remind the people that it's at times when the people's money are actually locked up in the actual banks
in the
of
banks,
Lebanon.
Yes,
at the same time, it's a secure place for them to invest. But going back to the sanctions and the pressure against Hezbollah, we had Biden stating that when he takes office in at least like 7 or 8 days, he will end Trump's maximum pressure policy against Tehran, hence against all the allies of the resistance in the region. Why is Hezbollah still very hesitant of showing any signs of optimism following Biden's victory?
Well, we have been taught, we have been really earned a lot of knowledge about these administrations, whether the Democrats or the Republicans. If we don't see any advantages from any of them, so we can't talk about good intentions from these presidents. So let's wait and see. Biden and Obama, his president, he was vice president of Obama, did not show any good intentions towards Iran or towards Lebanon. But I guess the balance of power now in the whole world is changing. Mm-hmm. Probably would the Americans go back to their mind and let the peoples determine their self-identity and self-independence. And their autonomy and their slogans and their way of life, I guess that needs to be waited until Biden can really be there in the White House.
We don't know if he's going to make it or not. One more threat is out there in the face of all Lebanese people is Israel. It keeps threatening a resumption of full-fledged hostilities against the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, but mainly against all of Lebanon here, but especially they keep saying that in the near future, they keep repeating that word. But I mean, its leaders were obviously disappointed by the loss of Trump in the election, and they basically have lost their main, maybe focal point of normalization in the region in West Asia. Is a full-fledged war against Hezbollah a viable option for Israel at this point in time?
Absolutely not. They have tried many times in many wars against Hezbollah and against Lebanon, and they failed in all these wars. So I guess they are trying to maneuver the psychology of of people, but the people in the south and in all Lebanon, they challenge these statements from Netanyahu or from some of its soldiers. But I guess the upper hand is for the resistance in this region, especially in the south. And I guess this maneuver would not help them. Otherwise, they will be the losers in any coming war if they try to attack any place in Lebanon. Even they can't escape even the avenge of Hezbollah for one fighter martyred in Syria. How could they dare to do such a war? I really further say that they can't and they would not do that.
Well, we have to test maybe and see whether these threats are going to be actually viable or not. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator, for joining us in Beirut to talk about the maximum pressure game that Washington is playing with the axis of resistance, and namely Hezbollah in the region. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the new agreement in the PGCC.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Qatar will not halt or make concessions in its relationships with Iran. This is what the Qatari foreign minister declared last week following a solidarity and stability agreement that was signed by Persian Gulf leaders in a landmark summit that took place in the ancient desert city of Al Ula. Saudi Arabia and its allies have restored full relations with Qatar, ending a huge rift that erupted 3 years ago. New Persian Gulf ties in this following report.
The end of the so-called Persian Gulf Rift would constitute a major regional step to adopt a foreign policy that is more attuned to the sensitivities of the other members and thus moderate eventual excesses. This was evident when Qatar declared that it will not alter its relations with Iran last week following a solidarity and stability agreement that was signed by the Persian Gulf leaders in a summit that took place in the ancient desert city of Al Ula. Saudi Arabia and the UAE reconciling with Qatar is a sign that the latter has made few concessions after securing a deal to break the blockade against its borders. Another important development could be vis-à-vis the relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Qatar's connections with the Persian power are well known and could be used as a means for an end by timid rapprochement in the region of West Asia. Many people have already forgotten that the rift started in 2017 with serious policy differences over how the countries of the Persian Gulf should deal with Iran and treat the Muslim Brotherhood groups contending for influence in the war on Syria. As the rifts begin to heal with this new announcement, the underlying differences have not really been resolved. The parties, at least, have agreed to end the rift's more visible and disruptive effects. The ripple effect of the PGCC internal rivalries has been central to the proxy dynamics that have underpinned and shaped the outcomes of political and military developments across the region of West Asia and North Africa since the popular uprisings began in 2011. Despite the purported rapprochement between Persian Gulf parties, it is worth noting that this is seemingly influenced by a desire to preempt pressure from an incoming Biden administration more than a genuine commitment to conflict resolution.
As such, the agreement within the PGCC is very unlikely to significantly affect geopolitical dynamics beyond the states involved. Third-party states such as Libya, Tunisia, Sudan, Morocco, and Egypt will remain theaters where Persian Gulf players and their allies will continue their proxy interventionism and their scramble to settle geopolitical scores.
To discuss this issue with us from London is Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Thank you for being with us, Sami, to discuss this new agreement between the Persian Gulf states, between Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and also Egypt is there. They cited Doha's ties to Iran and Turkey as core reasons for their extraordinary decision back in 2017 to cut diplomatic and transport links to Qatar. Yet today, after the new side agreement between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the former still insists that it will not change its relationship with Iran. So what was the point of the severance to begin with?
I think it's important to remember or to highlight that the blockade had nothing to do with Qatar's relations with Iran or any of the 13 conditions that were imposed, except when it comes to Al Jazeera's coverage. The blockade was imposed primarily because Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain were essentially very worried and very concerned by Qatar's ongoing support for movements that lean more towards the popular desire, whether that's in Tunisia, whether that's in Libya. By that, I don't necessarily mean that Qatar supported democracy or democratic trends, but that Qatar supported a movement that threatened the regimes of Saudi Arabia, of UAE, of Egypt, and Bahrain. And I think the Iran point was more to try to get the U.S. on board, to get Trump on board, as opposed to anything seriously regarding Qatar and Iran's relationship.
Well, that's really interesting, Sami, because it's being propagated on most Western mainstream media that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the kingdom's actual day-to-day ruler, wanted to resolve the rift to gain credibility with the upcoming Biden administration in the U.S. What is Mohammed bin Salman afraid of here? So, I mean, Biden becomes president and he is still at war with Qatar. What would happen then? Who cares?
I think the Democrats have always been averse to Mohammed bin Salman following the murder of Khashoggi. They've been averse to Saudi Arabia's role in the war in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis and the inability of the Saudis to bring about a resolution either by peace or either by military solution in Yemen. The U.S. is not really interested in peace. It's always interested in who the winner is. But given there is no winner and given that there is a humanitarian crisis, there is a fear that the Democrats will implement retrospective punitive measures on Mohammed bin Salman. Mm-hmm. Mohammed bin Salman believes that Al Jazeera and Qatar's extensive media outlets in English and in Arabic have played a key role in fueling anti-Bin Salman sentiment in Washington. Their lobbying networks, very influential, have influenced attitudes in Washington towards Mohammed bin Salman. That's Bin Salman's perspective, by the way, not necessarily mine, which is that Bin Salman's actions naturally bring about...
I wanted to say that, because basically there are war crimes in Yemen.
So a deal from the Qataris that the media outlets will be quiet, that they will give him some peace, and this is about shelving contentious issues, including Yemen, where we saw the formation of a government and a willingness to now negotiate with the Houthis, including this idea that Bin Salman now is trying to shelve any contentious issue that might draw antagonism from Biden. And this is why it's important to note, if Trump had won, it's very unlikely we would have seen any reconciliation at all.
Exactly. Well, also, we have many analysts, especially regional ones, saying that the OE in particular had been reluctant with regard to the rapprochement that happened with Qatar, partly because of Abu Dhabi's concerns about Qatar's growing relationship with Turkey as the power struggle between the two states intensified last year, specifically in Libya, for example. But what changed UAE's mind? I mean, could there be any benefit for them out of this reconciliation right now?
The UAE's power in the region is underpinned by its alliance with Egypt and Saudi Arabia and taking advantage of their weaknesses. And that is what has made the UAE into a regional power. It's an alliance of fear between UAE and Saudi Arabia, not an alliance of common aims or ambitions. And the UAE is seething with anger that Bin Salman acted unilaterally and dragged UAE into a reconciliation that it did not want, it did not seek. You will remember that Youssef Al-Utaiba, the ambassador, the UAE ambassador to Washington, said in the middle of November that reconciliation was not on anybody's priority list. There was a sort of defiance coming out of the UAE. Abdul Khalik Abdullah on Twitter, a prominent UAE commentator, said there will be no reconciliation without the UAE's consent, drawing the ire of Saudis who said, who are you to talk about Saudi Arabia like this? We are the big brother in the region. Mm-hmm. I think the UAE did not want it because it believes it doesn't need this reconciliation. The UAE believes that its normalization of ties with Israel puts it in good stead with an incoming Biden administration. It's been developing its ties with Iran over the past 2 years, so it's ready for these negotiations that are expected between Biden and Iran. And it believes that Bin Salman, his fears are exaggerated over a Biden administration, and that together they are able to resist any antagonism from Biden. And this is why we see that even statements coming out from UAE and from Egypt, which suggest more confusion than acceptance of this reconciliation. And also Qatari insistence that this was more a reconciliation between, a bilateral reconciliation between Saudi and Qatar, as opposed to with the wider countries.
I want to thank you very, very much, Sami, and I will have you back again so we can talk about this. Thank you for your time. Now, please stay tuned next week. We will talk more about this on the Mideast Stream.